You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, first responders are getting special training to help in emergency situations with people dealing with emotional disturbances. We'll get the details in a new report from WisContext. First, the Trump administration's sanctions against Iran went into effect today. It's leaving some in the international community looking for ways to get around them. These are similar to sanctions in place before the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Yesterday on Fox News, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called the sanctions the toughest to ever be imposed on Iran.
I am very confident that the sanctions that will be reimposed this Monday, not only the crude oil sanctions, but the financial sanctions that are being put in place by the Treasury Department and over 600 designations of individuals and companies in Iran, will have the intended effect to alter the Iranian regime's behavior. That's our expectation. It's the reason for President Trump's policy.
Nahal Tusi is a foreign affairs correspondent with Politico. Nahal, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to us about the basics of these sanctions. What do they do?
Well, they target Iran's oil sector, its shipping sector, its shipbuilding sector, and its banking sector. These are really the biggest, most important sanctions that the U.S. is reimposing on Iran since President Trump walked away from the nuclear deal.
And you said reimposing. How similar are these to sanctions in place before that nuclear deal was reached?
Well, basically, they are the reimposition of all the sanctions that were in place before the nuclear deal was reached, in addition to additional sanctions. So they basically made them even tougher than they were before. They put more people, more entities, more organizations on this list, hundreds more. And it's, you know, just a question of whether or not it's going to have the effect that they want, which is to change, radically change, the Iranian government's behavior.
And what behavior has the Trump administration cited specifically?
They're very unhappy with Iran's military activities beyond its borders, its role that it's playing in Syria, that it's playing in Yemen, the influence that it has in Iraq, in Lebanon, its funding of organizations, terrorist organizations like Hezbollah and other militias across the Middle East, its support for terrorist and assassination activities in Europe. Of course, they're also unhappy with Iran's ballistic missile program and what they believe remains Iran's intention to one day have a nuclear weapons program.
Right, that list, except for the last item, that list is what critics of the Iran nuclear deal under the Obama administration have pointed to. That deal really focused very specifically on the nuclear development program, leaving off all that other stuff. And that's been a sore point for President Trump and others, right?
Well, yes. I mean, President Trump and others, first of all, say that the original nuclear deal, even though it was really quite narrow, wasn't strong enough to begin with. But the president has also said, look, it should have been a much bigger, more comprehensive deal. It should have dealt with everything from the ballistic missile programs to Iran's support for terrorism to even maybe its human rights abuses. And frankly, it's an interesting idea to try to get that sort of a major deal with a country that's been an enemy of the United States for four decades. But I'm not sure how realistic it is to be able to accomplish that sort of thing.
Was there a hope under the Obama administration that, okay, with the contacts we've made, with the efforts we put into the nuclear deal, maybe in 5 years, I don't know, we can start working on those other issues?
They never really officially said that very clearly. I mean, they were pretty careful in their public remarks during the Obama years to say, look, this is just about nuclear weapons and just, you know, hold us to that. And if Iran ends up having nuclear weapons before this agreement expires or parts of it expires, then we will have failed. And that's all they wanted to be judged by. But, you know, behind privately, of course, they were saying, look, it's really great that we're finally talking to the Iranians after all this time. And maybe now that we've removed the taboo on this idea of talking to them, then we can ultimately discuss other things. But that was a very, very different time.
Talking to Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent with Politico, about U.S. sanctions with Iran resuming today, along with some added ones, even beyond what was there before the 2015 nuclear deal. Nahal, can you talk about reaction from the other parties to the Iran nuclear deal? This was not just a U.S. and Iran thing.
Correct. I mean, there were several European countries as well as China and Russia who helped negotiate the nuclear deal. For the most part, those other parties have been pretty unhappy with the fact that the Trump administration has quit the nuclear deal. The European countries, Britain, France, and Germany, have been trying to find some sort of a work around the sanctions, some sort of financial mechanism that would let them do business with Iran without violating U.S. sanctions. They're still working on it, and I'm not sure how much luck they're going to have with it. But yeah, there's a lot of unhappiness. They feel like it was a diplomatic mistake on the Trump administration's part. At the same time, there were a lot of people who were warning, look, the U.S. can't unilaterally reimpose sanctions. It'll never work. It needs the support of the rest of the world. But to be honest, they're doing it, and Iran's economy has been really hit by it already before these sanctions even took effect. So, I mean, the U.S. sanctions by themselves are having more of an impact than a lot of critics of the Trump administration predicted.
Is this an effort? Are people seeing this as part of an effort toward regime change in Iran, destabilize the economy enough that the populace, where we've seen protests in recent years, turns on the Iranian government?
Well, the administration insists that it doesn't want regime change, that it just wants the behavior of the regime to change. Of course, the demands that it has put for that behavior change kind of effectively amounts to a completely different regime, effectively. But yeah, there are a lot of people who are worried that this administration hasn't really thought through the whole thing. I mean, let's say you put enough pressure on the Iranian regime and it does collapse. What comes next? Have they really thought this through? Is it possible that the Iranian military might actually end up taking over and becoming an even more powerful force within the country? Or is it possible that Iran becomes another failed state, you know, a la Libya or Yemen, and there's all sorts of groups fighting one another for power? And you know, that really worries a lot of Iranians as well, which is one reason that so many of them are very wary of the Trump administration's approach to their country.
You recently reported about a change in some outreach channels to the Iranian public that the Obama administration created, kind of showing friendly messages and interviews with Iranian Americans, a big change in tone lately in those. Can you talk about that?
Correct. I mean, the Trump administration has been waging what I refer to as an information war against Iran. They are using every single opportunity and every single tool that they can think of, from Twitter to speeches to videos, to try to bring pressure on the Iranian regime. They want to erode support for the regime within Iran and outside of Iran. They want to paint the Iranian regime as everything from corrupt to bad at managing the environment of the country to, of course, you know, desperate to get nuclear weapons. And this is, you know, they're using every tool possible from, you know, what the U.S. had originally under Obama was a virtual U.S. embassy for Iran, which is basically a website. And the Trump administration has really turned that into a much more aggressive and critical website when it comes to talking about the Iranian government, whereas under Obama it was much more friendly and engaging. And it's really interesting to see how many of these different things that they're trying, but it's hard to tell how much of it is going to work because, for one thing, Iran has pretty strong censors and a lot of Iranians can't even get access to this material.
Some critics of the Trump administration strategy in Iran have said, okay, what about Saudi Arabia? A lot of the criticisms we could level at Iran, Saudi Arabia does them too, murdering dissidents overseas, human rights abuses, violations, attacks in Yemen, things like that. Are people comparing and contrasting here?
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of critics who say that this policy toward Iran is really very hypocritical, especially when you consider the friendship that the Trump administration has extended towards Saudi Arabia. This is particularly an issue when it comes to the concept of human rights. The Trump administration insists over and over again that it stands with the Iranian people, that it supports the Iranian people, and that it only doesn't like the Iranian government. And so when it criticizes the Iranian government, it criticizes it for things like not allowing religious minority religions to easily practice in Iran, or for carrying out untold numbers of executions, or for having corruption. But these are all things that you can find, in some cases even worse, in Saudi Arabia. The rights of women, for instance. You know, there's a very strong argument that Iranian women are much more free than Saudi women. And yet, when it comes to the Saudis, the Trump administration says nothing. But when it comes to the Iranian, it points to these flaws. And it just, you know, for a lot of critics, it just smacks of hypocrisy.
Historically, Nihal, how have the Iranian people, and I know this is a lot of people, we can't generalize about everybody, but in general, how have Iranian people reacted to U.S. sanctions against the country? Do they blame their own government for it, or do they kind of rally around the flag?
I think you're right. It's hard to generalize. For the most part, I think most Iranians just simply try to get by, try to survive. There's certainly a recognition that the U.S. power is what's behind a lot of the sanctions. But I would say that in recent years, there's also a growing frustration with the Iranian government itself, because it is a corrupt government on many levels, because it does have very poor management on many levels. And I think at a certain point, you know, it's for a lot of Iranians, it's not enough to say, oh, let's just blame all of our problems on America. They have been, you know, going out to protest more in recent months and doing all sorts of things that make it very clear that they also blame their own government for a lot of the problems in their country.
We'll leave it there for now. Nahal, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. She was with us to talk about the Trump administration's sanctions against Iran that went back into effect today. Coming up, we'll find out how first responders are trained to deal with people exhibiting signs of what's called excited delirium, often listed as a cause of death for people who die in emergency situations. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if your idea of a town in the 1800s includes some rowdy drinkers at the local saloon, gambling, even some duels in the street, a visit to one Wisconsin town around 1850 might match that image. Fair play. Now, a ghost town was a frontier community in Grant County. A historian tells us more about Wisconsin ghost towns coming up. First responders encounter people in a range of mental and physical states in the course of their work. But whether the first people on a scene are law enforcement officers or medical personnel can have a big impact on how people showing symptoms of a condition called excited delirium are dealt with. Haley Sperling is an engagement editor and reporter with WisContext. Her most recent piece is Examining the Emergency Medical Playbook for Treating Excited Delirium. It's a follow-up to a piece she wrote in June. Both of those articles can be found at WisContext.org. Ideas Network producer Chris Molina recently talked to Haley Sperling about the topic.
So this is your second article looking at this idea of excited delirium. Remind us what that means.
So excited delirium is essentially a medical condition that exhibits itself in individual, oftentimes dealing with either drug overdose, withdrawals, or any sort of mental health problems. Its symptoms generally include almost superhuman strength, body temperature increases, a kind of lack of response to general requests. So basically, it's kind of your body overheating, and then eventually, you know, if left unchecked, it can shut down.
Is there a medically agreed upon definition here or not?
You know, it's an interesting question because it's something that's really debated between the medical community and the law enforcement community. So law enforcement and EMS medical examiners generally accept it as a real medical condition, but it has been hotly debated, especially recently, because a lot of groups see it as more so a way for people to sort of cover their tracks. Excited delirium is typically used in cases of police use of force. So if a taser is used, if someone is taken down physically and then they inevitably die from those injuries, excited delirium has been noted as a cause of death. But, you know, its history comes about more so from the 1980s when it was used to describe cocaine overdoses in individuals. So, you know, they'd get that really rapid heartbeat, sweating, the superhuman strength, and then just suddenly kind of crash. But now we see it with these use of force cases where people have these symptoms exhibiting, but then are hit by a taser and inevitably succumb to those injuries.
So you talked about how the police use this, but in your most recent piece, you look at the issue of first responders in particular, who might be a police officer, might be an EMT worker, and how they deal with situations when they encounter an emotionally disturbed person, is the term, or an EDP. What did you learn about the protocols that are in place for first responders here?
So essentially what happens is that, you know, when police get a call, they really just have to listen to what is going on in the situation. So one of the main sources that I talked to just said it's really important right away to identify the situation as if, you know, if you find out that you're dealing with an EDP or someone dealing with excited delirium, that it's important to get the EMS team on the scene right away, because they'll be the ones who are able to actually administer the drugs and medicine to calm the person down. But oftentimes police are the first responders on the scene, so it's really up to them to calm the situation down, you know, try and talk to this person, even though, you know, they might not be in the proper emotional state to have a functioning conversation. But they're really in charge of kind of controlling the scene, making sure that there isn't a danger to themselves, anyone around the area, and that this person can be kind of subdued in an easier way. Police really, they, in their training guidelines and all the guidelines that I looked over for this reporting, you know, they mention calling EMS right away, so getting emergency medical teams on the scene, and then also using softer restraint practices. So, you know, not putting these people in handcuffs right away or something that could make them even further agitated and further elevate their heart rate or body temperature, which can all be really dangerous to that person in that situation.
And I'm curious, too, you've mentioned training. I'm wondering how much training is taking place about excited delirium, and where is that training coming from?
So for a lot of these first responders, you know, it's part of their required courses. For EMS training, it's a required, you know, subject matter for people wanting to go into that field to have to deal with this. There's also different groups across the state that help with this training. So one of them that I had spoken to for this article was the Crisis Intervention Training Team, which is hosted more or less by NAMI Wisconsin, which helps deal and, you know, educate the general population about mental illnesses and different mental health strategies. So what the CIT team does, they come in and they'll work with police departments or with EMS schools and help train people on handling these high stress situations. And this is about a 40-hour training with the CIT team.
We are talking right now with Haley Sperling. She's an engagement editor and reporter with WisConText, and her most recent piece is Examining the Emergency Medical Playbook for Treating Excited Delirium. And Haley, with the training and the protocols that we have been talking about, are these aimed at protecting the victims? Are they aimed at protecting the first responders, or a little bit of both?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because, you know, it really comes to the entire picture. You know, you want the persons, you know, suffering from this ailment to be safe. You want them to be okay. But then again, you don't want any of the officers or first responders on the scene to get hurt along the way, or any possible bystanders to get injured along the way. So one thing that police do when they get on the scene, you know, right after discovering that, okay, this is an excited delirium case, or this is a person who is emotionally disturbed, you know, after they call EMS, they try and, you know, secure the scene and make sure that any other people who could be put in harm's way are out of that way. And again, they're, you know, trying to use softer restraint tactics. So, you know, having multiple people, or multiple first responders rather, on the scene can help, you know, neutralize the individual in question without having to deploy any sort of tasers or anything like that. So what the police are really trying to do is calm everyone down, wait until EMS comes, and then EMS can come and actually, you know, administer ketamine, or, you know, haloperidol is something that's used as well to really physically calm someone down.
And in writing these articles, do you see any movement towards more informed and consistent responses in these situations?
You know, I think it's an interesting question because it's something that changes. You know, these protocols are examined all the time, and, you know, these, all the sources I've talked to, you know, they're constantly looking at new technology, and, you know, we live in a world that's constantly changing and developing every day, so they have to go with that. But generally across the board, the training has remained relatively the same. You know, it's getting someone on the scene, it's calling EMS, there's, you know, some minor discrepancies between drugs that are used, but overall it's a lot of ketamine, a lot of haloperidol. So I think people have kind of come to the consensus on what works and what doesn't. But, you know, like I've said in the past, there's always room for things to grow and change because, you know, these are professionals who are staying on top of the field and, you know, they're just trying to do the best work that they can. But, you know, that's every situation is different. So it can kind of just come down to the situation at hand.
And as we said, this was the second article that you wrote for WisContext looking at this concept. Do you have any additional plans to follow up on this reporting?
Yeah, so thanks for asking. there's actually going to be another article in the works. So one thing about excited delirium is that, you know, in past interviews, I've mentioned that it's not recognized by the APA or the AMA. It's also not listed in the DSM-5, I believe, or ICD-10, which are basically just the manuals that professionals use as the baseline to diagnose mental illnesses as well as just physical diseases. So when excited delirium is listed as a cause of death, it has to be categorized as something else because, like I said, the ICD-10 does not list excited delirium as an actual ailment. So it's not like a medical examiner can write down the corresponding number. They're going to be writing something else. So I'm trying to look into what is actually or what excited delirium is being coded as when it is listed as a cause of death and trying to find out how many times that code has been used in the state of Wisconsin and just kind of go from there and see how many times this has actually happened and what people in the medical community are really calling it when it comes down to the actual technicality of it.
All right, Haley, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Ideas Network producer Chris Molina talking to WisContext editor and reporter Haley Sperling about her most recent article on the topic of excited delirium. You can find this article and her previous one on the topic at wiscontext.org. Coming up, would you like to have a taste of the world's biggest ice cream cones? Well, you'd have to travel back to the early 1900s to visit the village of Strong's Prairie, now one of Wisconsin's many ghost towns. We'll hear from the historian and author of Wisconsin's Lost Towns for more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8:15 on the morning show, find out how climate change could threaten beer production around the world. That's tomorrow morning at 8:15 here on the Ideas Network. Now, it seems hard to imagine a once thriving town in a place that now has no traces that there was a town there. But Wisconsin is home to many lost towns that once were home to saloons, opera houses, post offices, schools, mines, sawmills, churches, and more. In various states of decay, these abandoned towns can be found spread out in counties all over the state. Whether they thrived for a decade or a century, they were homes to the people who came before us. Rhonda Fox is a regional historian living in Minnesota. She's the author of a series of books called Minnesota's Lost Towns. There's a Wisconsin edition, too. It's called Wisconsin's Lost Towns. Rhonda, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, how did you get curious about these ghost towns, these lost communities in the Midwest?
It's pretty easy. Actually, I've been doing it since I was as long as I can remember. My aunt in northern Wisconsin in Iron County up by Park Falls and Hurley, that area, she once owned property on which an old logging town once sat. And it was called Emerson, Wisconsin. And it was a quite substantial-sized town, but a freak accident happened during a lightning storm, and an Emerson brother and a nephew, I believe, were killed. And the town's folks just didn't want to continue on anymore, so they packed up, and the town was no more. And I can remember as a youngster going out and walking the acreage where that town used to be, and it used to amaze me. How could there be a town here? And now it's this deep wooded area way in northern Wisconsin. And then also my grandmother was the last postmaster of a lost town in Iron County called Powell, Wisconsin. And she basically was there the last day the post office was in operation, shut off the lights, and the town is totally gone.
What is it like for you when you find when you go to a lost town, you visit it for the first time and seeing what's left? What's that feeling of exploration like?
It's kind of you can almost feel it a little bit, but it's just an awe. You know, people settled this town, and it was their hopes and dreams, and it's their stories. You know, my Aunt Charlotte once said that land is land, but it's the people who are the history makers. And I try to imagine the people's lives there. They went to church, they went to school, they went to work, and all of a sudden, for some reason or another, that dream died, and they picked up and moved on. And what's left are just the physical remains, and hopefully, with viewers' help and stuff, we can put those stories together.
And that's a big part of what you do. You're not just cataloging, there was a town here, there was a town here, through the book. And it's a big book. You cover a lot of ground here. You share what you can find of stories of these communities.
True. Some towns leave a pretty substantial history, depending upon how well documented they are, and some leave little more than the dates that the post office operated. And some of the towns I only cover very briefly because that's all I could find. But I know there's more out there. I know I just hit the tip of the iceberg on these towns. I found about 200. There's got to be at least double, triple that we don't know the stories of yet.
And it's interesting. You share different classifications for ghost towns. There can be a wide range. Can you talk about the range of evidence of remains left behind?
One thing I discovered when I was starting to research ghost towns as a whole, and most of them are out west, but they range in classes or in descriptions. You can start out with a Class A town, and it's based on what's left today. So a Class A town is barren land. You would never know there was anything ever there, maybe a wide spot in the road or something. And then it goes up to a Class B, which there's some rubble left. And then a Class C town has abandoned buildings, and it's nothing of a town yet. And then you kind of get into a Class D, which is a semi or a near ghost town. It's still viable. There's still people there and residents and stuff, but it's not anything near what it was in its heyday. And you go all the way up to a restored historical community. And then eventually some towns are even absorbed by bigger towns.
Talking to Rhonda Fox, author of the book Wisconsin's Lost Towns. She's sharing stories of these communities that once were and are gone for one reason or another. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been to one of these? Do you have one near where you live? We'll go to your calls now. Eugene is with us in Viola. Eugene, hi there.
Hello there. I can name a few of them here in the area. And she may already be aware of, and the ones I'm thinking of are Kickapoo Center, Manning, Adili, Ash Ridge, Brush Hollow, White City.
You've been cataloging these, Eugene.
Pardon?
You've been finding these, it sounds like.
No, I've lived in this area a long time. I know where these places are at. Now, most of those crossroads are small towns. They were generally had just a cheese factory, a school, and a general store. And within your general store, you'd have your post office, and a lot of times you'd have a telephone exchange. Yeah, a switchboard.
Eugene, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Rhonda, I didn't track all of those down in your book, but I see Kickapoo Center is one of the stories in your book. And Eugene mentioned a lot of times it's crossroads and maybe one factory, one source of an economy. That's a pretty common theme for these lost towns, right?
It is. And, you know, basically what I set out to do it, I kind of set the criteria that it at one time it had a post office, not all of them, but most of them had a post office. And when the post office left, that pretty much the town lost its identity. And rural free delivery was a big transformer there. Once that came into being, a lot of post offices and a lot of communities died. And we're still losing post offices to this day. Just a side note, in about 1900, America had about 80,000 post offices. Today we have just over 31,000. So that's a lot of lost towns, a lot of lost communities.
Well, I want to hear a story or two about communities. You mentioned Powell, your grandmother, the last postmaster there in Iron County, I think it was. Can you tell us a little more about that lost town?
Yeah, it had a school and a church and a little general store, just like your viewer mentioned. And my grandmother was a post office, and when rural free delivery really took effect and the post office started to decline, and in May of 1942, she was the last day of official operation for the post office. So she had an official stamp. She stamped it and said this was the last day of the postal operation here. And it's kind of funny. I found on eBay, I actually found an envelope that she had signed, Hattie Holbrook, back in 1942, the last day she closed the post office. So basically, she turned out the lights, and the town kind of drifted away. The school is now a private home, and the railroad tracks were eventually picked up, and it's, you know, pretty much just in people's memories now.
I want to bring on another caller now. Mike is with us in Neshkoro. Mike, hi.
Good afternoon. I have a question for your guest about the, she had said initially that what got her into this was by the Emerson Lumber Company or something. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Go ahead, Mike.
And I was told by the old gentleman who owned it, that I bought it from, that it was run by, it was called Emerson Hill, and it was run by a family called, or an operation called Emerson Lumber Company in about the 1880s. And there was, the town that was there was called Cottonwood, and it was also known as Driscoll Spur. It would be about where the railroad bridge, railroad viaduct on Highway 8 is. I wondered if you ever heard of that, and I wonder if there was any connection between that Emerson and the one that you know of.
Mike, thanks for the call. We lost his connection there a little bit, Rhonda, but he was saying he had some land around near Prentice.
Right, and it's actually in about 20 miles from Park Falls. It's on a small county road. It's privately owned now. I have not heard of the Emerson Lumber Company, but the people that our family history, and I have a history. I was able to locate a history written by one of the sons of the Emersons, and I only knew it as Emerson. And it was a substantial size. It was a logging town. It had been formed in about the late 1800s, and a tornado had gone through the area previously, and a lot of down timber was there. And thus the Emersons came in and took that down timber and started the sawmill at Emerson. But I had not heard of Cottonwood or any of those, so...
Maybe for the sequel. Mike, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Rhonda Fox, regional historian, author of the book Wisconsin's Lost Towns. We're talking about those lost towns, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you know of a Wisconsin lost town or ghost town you'd like to share? Do you drive by some abandoned sites or hike by when you're out in nature? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Rhonda Fox, regional historian, author of the book Wisconsin's Lost Towns, about ghost towns all over the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there an abandoned town where you live? Maybe in your backyard? Did you grow up near one? In one? Maybe you pass by some on trips to the summer cabin or a camping spot. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Back to your calls now. Lucy is with us in Black Creek. Lucy, hi.
Hi there.
Do you have a ghost town for us, Lucy?
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily ghost town, but because there's really nothing there. It's called Sweetheart City. It's up in Marinette County, it's north of Privet. And it's on. You see it on a map. Like if you look at a map of Marinette County. I just was wondering if the guest knew anything about that.
Lucy, thanks for the call. I don't see it in the index, but is that common? You might see something on a map and there's nothing there?
It is common. Sometimes, even if you listen to severe weather reports, you'll hear little towns that are actually ghost towns that used to be there, but they're still marked as a geographical place on the map. Especially if you get a little older map and stuff. I had not heard of Sweetheart City, but it sounds like an interesting story how that got its name.
Thanks, Lucy. I wonder what that story is. Rhonda, do you get people, as you come out with these books or talk about this, you keep hearing more and more from people about these other ones that you can add to your list?
Oh, absolutely. When I first came out with the first Minnesota book, I thought that was going to be it. And then I would travel the state a little bit more, and people would email me and stuff. And it's fascinating. I came out with enough for another two or three books, and I'm sure the same is in Wisconsin. I'm sure I'm missing a ton of them. And, you know, it's extremely hard. I work with the historical societies, which, by the way, are a gem. If you have any stories or photos of places, give them to the Historical Society. They're the keepers of our history. But I talk to libraries and stuff, and I would love, you know, it's the people that tell the stories, because otherwise they are lost to time.
Thanks for the call. Go next to Ryan in La Crosse. Ryan, hello.
Hi. It's an interesting one. Our last name, Geister, meaning ghost. There is a town developed by, I believe, my great-great-great-grandfather called Geisterville. And we don't have a clue where it is. We have an idea that it's in central north Wisconsin. he did own a lumber company in Chicagoland area and went up there to get wood and created this town. And we have pamphlets from this village, but it doesn't exist.
And you're hoping to track it down. Rhonda, do you have any advice on Geisterville? I don't think is in your index. You have a town name. You know roughly where it is. How would you go about trying to find out where it was?
The first thing that I did is there's a, it's called a FORTE postal history, and they have a listing of every post office in every state that ever was. And that's where I go first. I go there and I'll type it in. I'll go to Wisconsin or Minnesota and I'll type it in. And then it at least gives you the county name. And when the dates of when the post office existed. And from that, then you can start digging more into county records and stuff. But that's where I always go first, is to find out if it had a post office and how long it operated and exactly what county I'm looking in.
And what would you search for online to find that?
It's called FORTE Postal History. There's a gentleman in Las Vegas who just is a postal addict. Yeah, okay. He knows everything. But he's very thorough. So if you can go there, you can look in any state and type in your name or look by county and see what towns are around you. It's pretty fascinating. So
that's cool. Ryan, good luck hunting for the family ghost town. I'll go next to Greg with us in Madison. Greg, hi.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if your guest had any ideas for lost towns that I could possibly visit in the county of Dane.
Lost towns in Dane County. I'm flipping through. There weren't a ton, I don't think, on the list. That's where Pokerville is, though, right?
Yep. Dover and Pokerville. And sometimes there's also a website that will sometimes give you a and that's hit and miss if you can find that, a geographic location for a historical post office. But basically, I tried to find locations and put it in my book and stuff, general descriptions of where you could find it, but they are kind of hit and miss. There's some I know that are there, and I you'd never know it. But I know then there's others that you can find across the state, you know, that have some remains left, and you can dig around and look around and stuff. One thing I also say in the book is please be ethical. Whatever you take in, take out, and don't take anything out that you didn't take in. So,
and careful if it's private property too, right?
Right, correct.
All right, we'll go next to Vivian in Green Bay. Vivian, hello.
Hello. A comment and an observation. Observation, Connellsville in Ozaukee County. I was born in 1945, and at one point I remember walking a couple miles to get to the big city, which was Port Washington. Connellsville just sort of got swallowed up, but at one point it did have the school. It had a small general store. It had a mink ranch. And I don't even know when it disappeared, but it just sort of faded right off away. And then a question. Is there any connection between the loss of some of these small towns and our transportation highways?
Vivian, thanks. Rhonda, you do write that some communities disappear when a highway is built over them.
Right, and absolutely. If you kind of think back in history, our first communities were built along the river. And then as railroads came into being, towns were located about every 8 miles on the railroad, because that's how far a farmer could get to and back in a day with their products and their produce. So first of all, it was the rivers, the railroads, and then the highways. And I still see that happening today. I happen to live by a town, small town, and people work in bigger towns and they go shopping there, and so you have no need of your local stores. And a lot of those are dying out when the highway switches. So transportation plays a major role in some of the towns this loss.
Vivian, thanks a lot for the call. Rhonda, as we start to wrap up, as you said, you know, there's just the tip of the iceberg there. Do you see a sequel to Wisconsin's Lost Towns in the future?
I would love to, because every town I find, I'm like, and I wrote down the names of the ones your viewers gave me, and now I'm going to be off on a search. One of the things is, too, go to the library, find any local history books. There may be mention of them. Especially local histories that are, you know, not self-published or something. Local historical societies will have them. But, no, I absolutely love lost towns. And, you know, every time I find one, it's like finding a jewel.
Fantastic. Rhonda, happy hunting, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Rhonda Fox is a regional historian living in Minnesota. She's the author of a series of books called Minnesota's Lost Towns and the book we've been talking about, the Wisconsin version. It's called Wisconsin's Lost Towns. Voters will head to the polls tomorrow to decide whether to re-elect Governor Scott Walker to a rare third term in office. Walker faces Democratic challenger Tony Evers in what polling suggests is his toughest race yet. As Sean Johnson reports, the circumstances couldn't be more different than when Walker was first elected 8 years ago.
In 2010, Republicans around the country captured 11 governor's offices previously held by Democrats. Winners that year included Sam Brownback.
No more Obama way, now to the Kansas way.
John Kasich.
Guess what? I'm going to be governor of Ohio.
And Scott Walker.
Tonight, I want to tell every worker, every family, and every business, big or small in this state, that you have an ally in the governor's office. Wisconsin is open for business.
Walker is the only governor from that group who's running for a third term. Marquette University pollster Charles Franklin says it's a different landscape than in Walker's previous runs, because for the first time, there's a Republican president in the White House.
Those are things that almost always work against the president's party, whether we're talking about congressional or gubernatorial elections. So Walker's facing headwinds on the national scene this year that he's not confronted in his previous elections.
Democratic ads in this race have hammered home Walker's tenure in office. 8 years, they say, is long enough. They've also reminded people of Walker's brief run for president in 2015.
So who do you think will really help our kids? The politician who put his ambition ahead of our schools, or the teacher who's dedicated his life to making them better?
Those ads have downplayed Tony Evers' political experience, talking less about his three successful runs for state superintendent of public instruction and more about his early career as an educator. While Evers praised Walker's most recent budget, he's criticized Walker's earlier school funding cuts and promised to spend more on schools if he's elected.
This election is bigger than Scott Walker, and frankly, it's bigger than me. This election is about our kids.
Walker has also talked about his 8 years in office, but he frames it as a warning.
Remember back 8 years ago, this state was suffering. It was a mess. We had double-digit tax increases, billion-dollar budget deficits, and record job loss.
The close election has pushed both candidates into unfamiliar territory. After saying earlier in the race that he was open to raising taxes, Evers has been promoting a substantial new income tax cut. And with polls showing the Affordable Care Act's protections for pre-existing conditions extremely popular, Walker has promised to safeguard them in state law.
So enough with the scare tactics. In Wisconsin, pre-existing conditions are covered. And as long as I'm governor, they always will be.
That ad caught President Obama's attention when he visited Milwaukee to campaign for Evers. Obama noted that Walker was making the claim at the same time he was authorizing Wisconsin's participation in a lawsuit that seeks to overturn the ACA.
That is some kind of goal. That is some kind of chutzpah. But let's also call it what it is. It is a lie.
President Donald Trump has also gotten involved in Walker's race. And despite his relatively poor approval rating with independent voters, Wisconsin Republicans have welcomed him. Trump and Walker appeared together at a Mosinee rally last week, where Trump praised Walker for helping bring Foxconn to Wisconsin and called the governor a great friend.
Scott fights every day for you, and now we need you to fight for him. And all you have to do is go out and vote.
The high-profile visits have continued. Vice President Mike Pence campaigned in Wisconsin over the weekend. Former Vice President Joe Biden visited days before that. Walker's attempt at a third term in office has not gone unnoticed, and it's not coming easy. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out why residents of rural Wisconsin are having a hard time getting access to mental health care. Take a break from election talk tomorrow with a hot topic, the rise of the chili pepper. Find out how hot peppers took over the world and share your favorite. If you're a fan of cooking with them or eating food cooked with them, we'll want to hear from you. And we'll hear about an annual project that plants wild rice seeds in the Green Bay area, an effort to keep that crop up and available for harvesting out into the future. All that and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's coming up tomorrow on Election Day here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 6:30, a Wisconsin expert on Alzheimer's disease shares the latest on efforts to find effective ways of preventing and treating the condition. And you can call in with your questions. That's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take an in-depth look at another race in tomorrow's elections, Wisconsin's race for Attorney General. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.